Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts' highest court strikes down a challenge to the cap on charter schools. Also, the state attorney general says she's taking steps to prevent prosecutorial misconduct after a state drug lab scandal. And
concierge services, 24-hour doorman, and private elevators to your residence.
Luxury condos are sprouting up in Boston. What does that mean for the housing market, and should they be taxed differently? Plus, a new documentary challenging our perception of intelligence and what can be determined about someone from an IQ test.
The IQ test measures a very limited potential of our brain to learn and misses all the other stuff.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Let's begin with the ruling today from the state's highest court on charter schools. Now, you may have thought that battle ended in 2016 with the defeat of the most expensive ballot initiative in state history, but some of those behind that ballot question went the legal route. And today, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court affirmed a lower court's dismissal of a challenge to the state cap on charter schools. Joining me is WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, who's been following this story. Hi there, Max.
Hi, Deb.
So these students in this case, what were they arguing in the case that went before the SJC?
Yeah, the plaintiffs, they're five anonymous students. All of them go to Boston Public Schools, particularly Boston Public Schools that are judged to be in the bottom 20% of schools statewide in terms of test scores. Mm-hmm. And all of them applied to go into one of these higher performing charter schools, and all of them were denied, probably as a function of that cap, right? There aren't enough seats for everybody who wants one. There's the big issue in this court case. Is that missed opportunity? Does that amount to an infringement of their rights under the Massachusetts Constitution to an adequate education? And today, the Supreme Judicial Court said, in a pretty resounding way, no, it does not.
Yeah, unanimous decision. What essentially did the court say here?
Well, they had, in the opinion, they say, yes, these students may indeed be being underserved by their schools. But again, that doesn't amount to an infringement of their rights. They said those schools may have a chance to get better. Certainly the state is watching them pretty closely, looking for ways to mm-hmm. tweak and adjust their approach so that their test scores and other educational outcomes might improve. They've had some success, like up in Lawrence, where they took over an entire district and turned test scores around. And the court went further. They said even if the state were failing, raising the charter cap isn't the only thing we could do, and the court really doesn't have the latitude to do that. They said they're not allowed to follow or to order fundamentally political, that was the quote, fundamentally political remedies to big questions of equity in school.
And, you know, we mentioned in the beginning that there was the 2016 ballot question on charter schools, and that would have allowed up to 12 new charter schools or expansions every year. But now after this ruling, what do you think is next for charters and then the whole movement to improve some of the lower performing traditional schools?
Well, the Mass Association for Public Charter Schools released a statement saying there's still room under the cap in some communities. So there are places where they can still expand, but where there are already a lot of charter schools, namely in the state's big cities, there isn't as much room. And they said they were frustrated by what felt like an arbitrary limit. And at the same time, it seems like the argument against charter schools has kind of taken hold. I spoke to attorney Matt Kreger, who filed a brief in support of leaving the cap in place. He said the kind of students who don't always get or keep seats in charter schools, namely students with disabilities, English language learners, he said lifting the cap would be doubly harmful for those particular populations.
First, it takes money from the schools that are required to serve everybody. And second, it eliminates the number of choices that they have available as their schools shrink and the number of charters increase.
So that, coupled with the fact that the charter school cap increase was defeated by a 24-point margin just 2 years ago. He says this is an invitation to move on from this particular partisan fight.
But, you know, this has been something that Governor Baker supported since he was elected. He appeared in ads for that failed 2016 ballot question. What about the governor and other charter advocates? I mean, does this ruling really mean and signify to them that this fight is over?
I think politically you have to wonder, is there a certain point at which you have to take no for an answer? This has now been considered by the legislature, by a ballot initiative, and in the courts. And there just seems like there isn't an appetite or a legal basis to raise the cap. But charter advocates say they're devastated, and they're questioning the logic of the ruling that came out today. I spoke to Carrie Rodriguez. She worked on the Yes on 2 campaign back in 2016. She herself says she has two sons who are on the waiting list to go to charter schools. And she pointed out that Massachusetts has one of the worst achievement gaps in the nation for Latino students like her two sons. And she doesn't buy the argument that parents like her should just sit back and wait for the Commonwealth to fix big problems like that one.
Over what period of time are we talking about? Because parents get roughly 12 years to get their kids an adequate education. So are we just supposed to roll the dice and hope the Commonwealth is able to figure this out?
So what should we be looking for next here, Max? Is the fight over?
I don't think it's ever going to be over, right? There are moneyed interests and that really would like to see more charter schools expanded. There are parents like Carrie Rodriguez who feel very strongly that we have the best charter schools in the country for a reason. There should be more of that. I think it's worth pivoting out and looking at the question a bit more broadly, though. Brockton, one of the most financially beset districts, really, really big school district, is considering a different kind of litigation that could make its way up to the Supreme Judicial Court. They're going to argue, if they go forward with the suit, that their public schools are just being underfunded, that because of money issues, that their students aren't getting that adequate education to which they're entitled. And it was that exact kind of civil action that prompted a huge new wave of public investment in the schools back in 1993. So if that goes forward, you'll see more money. And then there's a bill being considered this session, sponsored by Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, that could pour $1 or $2 billion more into education in the years ahead, too. So the court kind of indicated in the decision that they might look at those kind of complaints differently. And even Carrie Rodriguez, the charter advocate mom, says she's on board for that kind of litigation, too. We all want what's best for kids, after all, she said.
All right. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey is promising to make changes in her office in response to the ongoing legal fight over the Amherst drug lab scandal. In that scandal, former chemist Sonia Farrick admitted to stealing and using drugs that she was supposed to be testing for evidence in criminal drug cases. A district court judge also found that two former assistant attorneys general who worked under Maura Healey's predecessor, not Healey, committed fraud by downplaying Farrick's misconduct. In a brief submitted to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, the AG's office is promising to create an ethics committee to help provide oversight. Healey told us this month that she's committed to better training prosecutors.
We have undertaken extensive action in terms of ethics trainings, prosecutorial trainings, establishment of an ethics committee, and any number of other steps. This is something that I took personally very seriously, as you can imagine. This is about ensuring that we have the systems in place that work.
But there are some attorneys who are skeptical. For more, we turn to defense attorney Jared Olinoff. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So let's first note here that the misconduct that we're talking about in terms of the two former prosecutors, and we did mention that it was not under Maura Healey, it was under previous Attorney General Martha Coakley. So these changes regarding those former prosecutors and regarding the scandal with Sonia Farrick herself, what's your initial reaction?
Well, the prosecutorial misconduct by each of those two prosecutors was happened a variety of different ways. One was by laziness and incompetence. And so what happened was that there were a lot of documents that were in the trunk of Sonia Farrick's car that was searched by police, and the documents showed that Ms. Farrick had been stealing drug samples and, in fact, using drug samples herself for 8 years, which was 7.5 years longer than was initially suspected. And so those documents stayed in the hands of the Attorney General, for at least 2 years after the scandal broke. And defense attorneys like myself, start as soon as the scandal did break, requested any documentation regarding the timing and scope of Ms. Farrakh's misconduct. The one attorney general knew about the documents. She was notified early on that they existed. And she, according to Judge Carey, in his decision, deliberately withheld them because it was going to make another enormous scandal like the Annie Dukin drug lab scandal that happened in Boston. Mm-hmm. And the attorney general, for whatever reason, mostly because of lack of manpower or
You know what, we can't go into the whole history here because we don't have enough time, but what I'm wondering is your initial reaction to these changes that the attorney general is proposing. We know about Sonia Farrakh. We know that a lower court judge did rule that these two former prosecutors did commit fraud on the court because they were not forthcoming about the extent of Sonia Farrakh's misconduct at the lab and how many cases were involved, and that may have been because they had this other drug lab scandal brewing. But right now the AG says, look, this is what we're doing. These are the reforms that I've implemented. You say, are they good or are they not good?
Well, they're neither here nor there. You know, a protocol to turn over evidence is only as good as the people who are hired to do it. And so if you have good prosecutors who are willing to turn over their entire file and say, look, this is all of the evidence in the case, here you go, then the system works properly. If you have people who don't want to do that, and then the people above them aren't making sure that they're turning everything over, then the system fails, which is what we saw here. So this wasn't just, in our view, two prosecutors who didn't do their job. We believed that there were other people involved in just a lack of oversight up and down the ranks.
Hmm. You know, we did speak with Attorney General Healey earlier this month about this and asked her about the Farrakh case. And I want to play a little clip of what she said here. Let's listen.
We've worked very hard as an office to advocate for the reforms to make sure this never, ever happens again. And we've accepted the court's findings about the conduct of two assistant attorneys general who worked under the prior administration.
So Attorney General Healey says, you know, she does take this seriously. She has worked for reforms. The Mass Bar Association is saying that they're going to work with the attorney general and participate in a new statewide task force on conviction integrity. Will those things help?
No, because they are disingenuous. When it was first discovered that two of her lawyers under Martha Coakley administration had hid this evidence from us, instead of saying, wow, we messed up, how can we make this right, they fought tooth and nail to prove that those things didn't happen, that they didn't deliberately withhold evidence. And in fact, they sent their best and brightest prosecutors under Maura Healey's administration out to Springfield to fight us for a week and a half last December. In this hearing, and they claimed that they did absolutely nothing wrong. And so what happened, though, is people spent years in state's prison combined over this misconduct. And so they did not take steps. It's not the cases that were affected by this scandal. Most of them haven't even been dismissed yet.
So there was at one point a suggestion to issue monetary sanctions or perhaps maybe some sort of an effort to disbar these former prosecutors. We should say they're no longer working in the attorney general's office, but they are still working in a legal field. I mean, would those steps or what steps do you think would be the best way to try to resolve this?
I don't think that either of those two proposals will really do anything. You know, as a defense attorney, I myself see, you know, represent clients who have maybe done something that shouldn't define their entire life or their entire career. On the other hand, what happened here was extremely egregious. As I said, it cost people, cost people years of their lives. What is proper here is to not do any of those things that Maura Healey had suggested, but to actually dismiss the cases that were affected by this scandal. And those are not just the cases that Sonia Farak herself
Because the high court has agreed to dismiss, and some of the district attorneys have agreed to dismiss some 8,000 cases. You're talking about it should be bigger than that.
Not even close. That's not even close to fulfilling the obligation here, because Sonia Farak herself testified that she tampered not only with the samples that were assigned to her, but the samples that were assigned to every other chemist in the lab, and samples that had not yet been assigned to any chemist. And so everything that went through that lab from 2004 to 2012, the 8 years that she worked there, needs to be dismissed. And I am still boggled to this day, as someone who was there from day one, as to why this hasn't happened and no one is banging that drum, because that is only true justice at that point.
Rough idea of what number of cases that might be for those 8 years, Jared? What are we talking?
I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I do know, I think that it is in the range, if not greater than, Annie Dukin.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Jared Olenoff, he's a defense attorney. I want to thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Stay with us. Coming up, how should we tax the luxury condos that are sprouting up in Boston? I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The hot spring real estate market is officially in gear, and our next guest is calling for a closer look and different policies for the luxury end of the market. He says it's taking off, even in a Yankee stronghold like Boston. And luxury here means amenities such as private theaters and spas, golf simulation rooms, all at a cost per condominium of some $6 million on average. Chuck Collins with the think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies in Jamaica Plain, says most of these uber luxurious residences aren't actually homes, but what he calls sanctuaries that are nothing more than wealth storage units that help the very wealthy stay that way. He's also suggesting that these properties be subject to a different tax. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Deborah, for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. What's your housing situation? Are you looking for housing and experiencing sticker shock? Do you think these units are just what Boston needs to step up its game, maybe collect higher property taxes? And should these units be subject to different luxury taxes? Call us with your thoughts at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I also want to say that Evan Horowitz, who's the quick study columnist for the Boston Globe, is with us to join this conversation as well, because Evan, you have looked into a lot of things happening in the real estate world in Boston. So thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
So first off, Chuck, I want to start with you. Sanctuaries. I'm glad I can say that word. I'm kind of proud of myself, actually. But you say no one is living in these places. Can you explain?
Well, I wouldn't say no one is living in them, but one of the reasons people come from all over the world to buy these luxury apartment buildings is they're a form of wealth storage. They're an asset class, meaning that it's just like investing in the stock market and in bonds, and a wealthy billionaire or from another country will say, well, I'm going to invest in Boston real estate because it will hold its value. It'll be a safe investment. Right. I may come and visit once in a while. But very few, we know from looking at the other luxury towers, very few of them claim a residency exemption. So people aren't really living in them.
Right. So how many? What do the numbers look like?
Well, we know, like looking at Millennium Tower, maybe 25%, less than 25% have said that they'll take a residential exemption. Huh. And if you look at sort of the actual assessor's records, you'll see a huge number of shell companies, which is a telltale sign that this is sort of a shadow investment. It's a hidden investment. We don't necessarily know if it's a Russian oligarch or a Chinese investor or just somebody from down the road who's hiding the ownership.
So we don't have any idea who these investors are, the 75% of these folks who may not be taking the residential exemption here or may not actually be living in the units, just investing in them. Any thoughts on who they might be?
Well, we if you look at those assessor reports, you will see a huge number of names from China and Hong Kong. You can, we're just starting to research and Google that. But, invite me back in a month, because we're actually digging down a little bit into this ownership question.
Yeah.
But one simple rule change is to require a disclosure of what they call beneficial ownership, who really owns this unit, to sort of close off the money laundering side of this problem, which is a global problem.
Right, right. Evan, you've looked at some of these numbers, right?
I have.
What did you find?
Yeah. So it may be the case that there is a lot, I don't doubt, in fact, that there is a high vacancy rate in these apartments in the luxury end. And the question is, how much does this affect your rent? How much is it trickling down? And it's not clear how big an effect this is citywide. You've got about 300,000 apartments or housing units in the city of Boston. And about 5,000 of them, it seems, are classified as sort of rental places. I mean, that is vacation places, a second home, that kind of thing. And maybe another 4,000 to 5,000 that seem to be rented but unoccupied. So maybe somewhere between 1.5% and 3%. It's just, it doesn't mean it's not worth doing something about this problem. It just means you shouldn't think this is the answer to why the rent is too darn high.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but you do have a proposal for this, Chuck, and you're talking about a different kind of tax. Explain that.
Well, I would just agree with Evan that there's not a one-to-one nexus between this and rising costs, but we do know luxury housing like this pushes up land value. Mm-hmm. And even if it wasn't having a huge negative effect on the housing market, we could levy a luxury tax, essentially, for the services that the city provides, in addition to paying property taxes, a kind of graduated luxury tax. And so I would argue we should mimic San Francisco. We should have a very high-end real estate transfer tax, 1%, 2% on units over $2.5 million, mm-hmm. and a tax on vacant units so that properties that are sitting vacant for long periods of time also contribute to a housing, affordable housing fund.
But, some folks might say, well, I'm already paying a lot on my $2.5 million-plus piece of property, paying more than most are. And, if you're talking in a Millennium Tower kind of a way, most of us are paying some taxes and not using any city services. So aren't you already getting a deal? Why do I need to be taxed more?
Well, think of the wealth storage function that we're providing as a city. And if you look at the marketing materials, and actually I encourage people to look at onedalton.com's marketing videos, who they're reaching out to, it's not for people who live in Boston. It mm-hmm. is marketing to an international market. So what are they advertising? They're advertising safe, walkable cities, infrastructure, cultural institutions, all kinds of things, amenities that we as Bostonians create together through our taxes over time. And I think for the price of protecting those assets, if you will, we should ask for more from this particular clientele.
Hmm. Evan, your thoughts before we go to callers?
Yeah, I mean, this issue sits really at the intersection of two fundamental economic challenges. One is inequality. The other is housing prices, excessive housing prices. And one of the benefits of a tax solution is it can address both of these challenges. Higher taxes will feed money to the city, which could be used for rental vouchers, it could be used for affordable housing, it could be used for any number of things. It also can be redistributed in a way that affects inequality. Again, I don't think this is a solution to either of these problems, in toto, but as a step, it makes sense to think of them together and to think of taxes as a way to address them at the same time.
Okay. Listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. What's your housing situation, and what do you think of these luxury units? Are they exactly what Boston needs to sort of step up its game? Should they be subject to different luxury taxes? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Dylan is calling from Cambridge. Dylan, you're on the air.
Hi, I would like to ask your experts if they have thoughts on a foreign buyer tax. So this isn't so much a luxury tax as it is a tax on what I would call speculators without borders. Hmm. Your experts may know there are policies like that in Vancouver, Toronto, and I think the best practice in the world is in Singapore, where they tax both foreign investors and have a tiered tax for domestic investors. Any thought on that?
Okay, Dylan, that's a great question. Thanks so much for your call. Chuck, thoughts on that? A foreign buyer tax. Are you familiar with that?
I am. And both the city of Vancouver and the province of British Columbia have implemented some form of that. It a little bit borders on sort of this, blaming the foreigners thing. I think we should understand that this is global capital. It's both foreign and domestic. It's having a disrupting effect on our community. So I wouldn't distinguish between the different forms of capital. I wouldn't peg the tax just. And the other reality is most of these are, again, a large percentage are shell corporations. We actually don't know the national origins. They're kind of these layers of trusts and shell corporations. And it's hard to know whether this is wealth down the street or wealth from across the world. So I think it would become a huge distraction, actually, and I think it has in Vancouver a little bit.
Evan?
Yeah, I mean, the one reason to think differently, I think, about foreign investors is precisely the question of whether there's money laundering involved, whether they're trying to escape their own national capital controls. Like, one reason Chinese investors have been so interested in purchasing real estate abroad, whether it's on the East Coast here in Boston or on the West Coast in places like Vancouver, is to escape limits that the Chinese government imposes on their investments. And in that regard, it might be worth focusing on foreign investors as a group.
I want to take another call. David is calling from Cambridge. David, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I was just wondering if there's a comparison that can be made about what happened in San Francisco during the dot-com boom. The prices went up on housing that a lot of the artists and musicians had to leave the city, and it really changed the landscape. So just thoughts on that and whether or not you would consider a tax that would help subsidize the arts in exchange for development rights.
Okay, David, thanks so much for the call. Chuck, I'm wondering, you mentioned San Francisco earlier. Tell us what San Francisco is doing. And, you know, not all that long ago, I remember doing a segment about please don't let us become San Francisco. Everyone's afraid of you know, pricing so many people out. What's San Francisco doing to try to prevent this? And could Boston do something similar?
Well, I think Evan and I were talking about this. San Francisco has become kind of this inequality dystopia now. I mean, if you go and walk around the streets of San Francisco, you see the sort of stunning levels of inequality. And I think that's what led people to say, well, let's levy this high-end real estate transfer tax along with other interventions. So it's not just the one approach. But that tax has been in place. The voters supported it. It raised about $44 million last year. The City Council of San Francisco has designated it for two things. One is free community college to anyone who lives in San Francisco. So that has actually made a huge difference in the life of many San Francisco residents. They also invested in fixing the trees of the city. So there's no reason why, per David's call, why couldn't you could identify a number of uninvested things. People travel and want to live visit Boston because of the arts and cultural institutions. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should that should be part of what the luxury tax does, because that's essentially why some people are actually coming from around the world here.
Okay, I want to take another call. Jake is calling from Dedham. Jake, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. What are you thinking about the housing situation in Boston and these luxury units? Does something have to give here?
Yeah, so I think that the home ownership has been a way for my parents' generation and generations before that to acquire wealth, to get their foot in the door of upward mobility. And it seems like now with an increase in these sort of super decadent, over-the-top, lavish lifestyle houses, it's going to start to freeze out people from being able to participate in that area. It's going to end up stopping the middle class, the blue-collar workers, from being able to participate in that form of upward financial mobility that our parents and our grandparents were able to pass on to us.
Right. So you're concerned about how this affects home ownership in general. Is that right, Jake?
It absolutely does. I mean, we bought a home in Dedham because we couldn't afford to live just over the border in West Roxbury, where the housing prices were, for the same quality, same size, were $75,000 to $125,000 difference.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much for the call. Evan, what do we know about how far people are now moving out and what high housing costs are doing to the city of Boston?
Well, I mean, to Jake's point, I think Jake is right to worry about whether young families today can build assets through real estate the way their parents could. But I would only say, if you care about sort of the economic diversity of Boston proper, as opposed to greater Boston or distant Boston or whatever we're calling the places people have to move to now, if you care about, you know, Bohemia, as the previous caller was talking about the arts, then this is not the conversation. Then we have to have a different conversation, a conversation about rent control or social housing or a massive change in rental vouchers. Vacancy rates in luxury buildings is an issue worth discussing on its own, but it's not going to get you anywhere near what you need to do to address concerns like Jake's. That's going to require something much more fundamental in terms of changes to the way we treat housing and apportion housing units.
I just wonder, though, we have a proposal on the table for a million, quote-unquote, millionaire's tax, right? And one of, you know, I've noticed that folks ask these kinds of questions. You know, where do we draw the line?
Maybe I don't like, you know, maybe you should pay more because you drive a BMW, right? Maybe you should pay more to use the road because you have a luxury car. Maybe, you know, where is the line drawn, and where is the line drawn in terms of asking people with the money for more money for taxes? And how do we deal with that to make sure that we're being fair all the way around? I know there's gross income inequality, but what do we do? Evan first.
Well, I mean, with the millionaire's tax, you draw the line at $1 million. I mean, that the idea is, like, it's a civic decision. There isn't an obvious, natural, inevitable place to say everyone above this line or this level should pay more. This is an ongoing discussion. We go to voters every time. We say, we think someone goes to voters and says, we think $1 million is the right place to draw a line. Above that, you should have a surtax. And voters say yes, or voters say no, and you try again if that doesn't work. But I think, you know, line drawing like that is part of the civic process. But the difficulty of drawing lines is not a reason not to do it. It's just a reason to continually engage in this process and think about how we can raise more revenue and how we can address issues like inequality.
Mm-hmm. Chuck, your thoughts on where do we draw the line? Are we worried about a precedent here? And are we worried about scaring off wealthy investors, too?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should just remember that after World War II, we had a much more progressive, steeply progressive tax system at the federal level. We taxed income and wealth at higher levels. We invested in the kind of public infrastructure and public goods that helped build a white middle class after World War II. So I actually think we need to restore some of that progressivity, and I think the millionaire tax is one of those ways. I mean, it's wildly popular, even among some of the people who are going to pay it. By the way, I would suspect many of the people buying these luxury units are not residents of Massachusetts and will not pay that high income tax. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a tax on the transfer of very expensive apartments that would also capture some of that wealth as it touches down. So I'm comfortable restoring taxes that essentially are being paid by the top one-tenth of 1% of income and wealth holders, and investing it in the kind of public goods that it's really in everyone's interest at this point to not sort of further polarize, and including for people who are going to be living in those buildings. They're going to want to live in a Boston that has relative equality.
Yeah, but do people still think like that? I mean, look at where we're at, right? In this divisive time in our culture that, yes, it's not all about me. It's okay. I'm going to give up some of what I have for the greater good.
Well, in a way, that's why I like this real estate tax, this luxury real estate tax, because think about it. This is global wealth that's moving around the world, mostly avoiding taxation, and it's touching down in real property. This is one of the few places where, you know, we have trillions of dollars hidden in offshore tax havens now. This is actually showing up in our community. We don't even have to know if it's Evan who's the shell owner, because we'll just tax that unit as a unit. It's a place where we can actually make a difference on these extreme inequalities. So I think that's one strong reason for why. And I think we should move with a number of cities in tandem. You know, New York, Washington, D.C., Miami, all these coastal cities are dealing with the same issue. If we put forward the same package of high-end luxury real estate transfer taxes, vacancy controls, maybe disclosures of beneficial ownership, if everybody does that, then the millionaire migration problem is at least not going to be claimed. Mm-hmm. People are still going to move to Florida, but it won't be because there's a millionaire transfer tax.
Evan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the polling is clear that people do want to pay more in taxes. That is, the support for the millionaire's tax is quite high.
Can I say I don't?
That's fair enough. the great majority of people across the country, and dare I say in this room, but not everyone, is ready to pay more in taxes. You see it among the teacher strikes recently in these red states. They're polling people and people saying, yes, charge me more in order to provide better salaries for the teachers in my state.
All right. Well, we'll keep talking about this, I'm sure. Evan Horowitz, quick study columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Also, Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Deborah.
And thanks to our listeners as well for all of your comments on this topic today. Stay with us. Coming up, a new film questions what it means to be intelligent and how to empower people with intellectual disabilities. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A new documentary is challenging how we define intelligence. The film, titled Intelligent Lives, follows three young adults with intellectual disabilities. It's a call, the director says, for more inclusivity in schools and in the workplace for people with intellectual disabilities. It's also a call to reconsider how we measure intellect. The film will have its East Coast premiere at the Independent Film Festival in Boston on Friday. Dan Habib is the director of the film. He's also a filmmaker at the Institute on Disability at the University of New Hampshire, and he joins me now. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So your film, Intelligent Lives, focuses on the story of young adults primarily with different intellectual disabilities, kind of navigating this transition from childhood to young adulthood. Why yeah. did you want to make this film about that transition?
Well, honestly, so much of my work stems out of my own experience as a parent. My son Samuel is a high school senior who's got a great circle of friends. He's planning on going to college next year. He's involved in lots of extracurricular activities. He's also a kid who uses a wheelchair, has a communication device, can't really speak. And because of his different way of navigating the world, he's often seen as being less intelligent. And that's been our experience for his whole 18 years of his life. When I did the film, including Samuel, about him about 10 years ago, and I started showing it around the country, people continually said, well, sure, Samuel, who has physical disabilities, can be included in regular school, but certainly not kids with intellectual disabilities. Mm-hmm. So that question came up so much that I started realizing that there's a major systemic segregation of people with intellectual disabilities. Only 17% of high school students with intellectual disability are included. Only 15% of adults are employed. So it was really a way to look at this issue of segregation among this one group of Americans that I would say are the most segregated Americans.
Mm-hmm. And the film basically focuses on three young adults, mm-hmm. Micah, Nair,
right.
and Naomi. And I think for the purposes of our conversation, we'll focus on Nair. He's an aspiring artist at the Henderson Inclusion School here in Boston. So tell us a little bit about Nair.
Sure. Well, you know, Nair is the same age as my son Samuel, and I've actually been filming him his whole high school career. I started filming him as a freshman and wrapped up as during his senior year. And Nair represents an age range for a lot of students where many of them become even more segregated. Most high schools around the country would not be including a student like Nair who has significant autism and verbal challenges. He would be in a separate classroom, maybe even a separate school. But the Henderson School here in Dorchester is, I would say, one of the most inclusive high schools in the country. They do not segregate kids with disabilities, and they have many kids with significant disabilities. I've known the Henderson for a while. I've done some other filming there for other projects. And their principal, Tricia Lamprin, introduced me to Nair and said, you've got to meet this kid. He's an incredible young man, and he's a really gifted artist. And he expresses himself more through his art than through his words. And so I got to know him, his art teacher, his social studies teacher. And the kind of twist on Nair's story is he's also a tall black man with unpredictable behaviors because of his autism. Yeah. And so his father, Jamal, his social studies teacher, Samuel Teixeira, who's also African-American, have said to me they're concerned about how the world is going to perceive Nair when he's out in the community outside of this Henderson bubble. And as again, a tall black man with unpredictable behaviors in our society is vulnerable, you know, right. to things happening from the police and from others. So it's his story is pretty complicated.
Well, to that point, we have a clip from the film. One of Nair's teachers, his history teacher at Henderson, is Samuel Teixeira, and he describes the school and Nair's in it, sort of. Let's listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that intelligence looks different for everybody. It's clear that he has an intellectual impairment. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he can't be intelligent.
It meant to take seriously.
I have a lot of students who don't communicate in traditional ways and are nonverbal or do communicate in ways that the outside world sees as very different. And, you know, we always joke that the Henderson is sort of like Disneyland. Like, it's a special place. We're all family. People sort of get things and are patient. But sometimes it is troubling to wonder what might the outside world perceive him as.
So I'm wondering, Dan, you know, is the Henderson School like Disneyland, and does more need to be done really to prepare these young adults for a world that may perceive them very differently?
Well, I think – I honestly think that the best experience to be ready for the quote-unquote world is to be with your peers in a regular education environment throughout your whole career. And that's what's happening throughout the Henderson schools and through many schools around the country. I mean, there's 30 years of research that show that kids who are included – kids with disabilities who are included in regular education end up with better employment outcomes, better post-secondary outcomes in terms of college. They have stronger communication skills, more behavioral management. They have better relationships in their life in terms of romantic relationships. So, you know, Henderson knows the research. And I think that that is also a real benefit to kids without disabilities because, you know, they need to see that this is the real world we live in. And when we talk about diversity, diversity is certainly ethnic and racial. It's around gender. It's around sexual orientation. But it's also around disability. So I really think Henderson embraces that as part of their diversity.
Right. But you know, it's always resources, I guess, in one way mm-hmm. or another. And some folks might say, do we have the resources to make supportive environments for everyone, also fair to everyone, you know, disabled mm-hmm. and non-disabled kids alike, because there are some kids who are in regular ed programs who may be distracted. And at one point in the film, you show Micah's sister who works at a teacher as a teacher in an inclusive classroom. And sometimes she seems to be a bit overwhelmed and struggling, you know, to work with some of her students as if teachers are listening. What do you say to them that there would be ways to help them include everybody and make sure that everybody, you know, gets the attention they need in a classroom?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, education is complex. It's a very difficult job no matter what the environment is. Mm. One of the interesting things about Henderson is that it has some of the highest test scores also in the city. In fact, there's a waiting list of, I think, almost 1,000 kids without disabilities to get into Henderson, which is the most inclusive school in Boston. It's interesting, you know, people talk about resources a lot. I've had the chance to travel and do filming in schools all around the country. I was in the Mississippi Delta not long ago filming, one of the poorest communities I've ever been in, 100% free and reduced lunch, you know, community, also happens to be 100% African-American. They were doing inclusion incredibly well because it wasn't just one teacher's responsibility. They had the occupational therapist in the room helping out, the physical therapist. They at one point had a custodian come up and watch a classroom while the teacher was working with a small group of kids. So I think schools that recognize this is an all-hands-on-deck approach to make sure that all kids can be successful, they're the ones that are doing it well. And I've been in some wealthy communities that say, oh, we can't do inclusion. And I say, you know what? If they can do it in the Mississippi Delta, they can do it in your community as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the film's narrator is actor Chris Cooper, who talks about mm-hmm. his son, Jesse, with cerebral palsy. And Chris right. Cooper fought to have Jesse included in general education. And early on in the film, he talks about the Stanford-Binet IQ test. And let's listen to what he says.
The IQ test told us nothing about my child's potential, about who he was as a person. Can any attempt to measure intelligence predict a person's value or ability to contribute meaningfully to the world?
And Dan, the reason I bring that up now is because we're talking about sort of inclusion and general education. And I'm wondering, when so much is focused on not just Stanford-Binet, but standardized testing mm-hmm. in general, you know, do you have a big battle ahead of you? And then we'll talk a little bit about the Stanford-Binet.
Yeah. Well, I think I love Chris's line there where he says, can any measure of intelligence predict a person's value to contribute meaningfully to the world? To me, that's the synthesis of the whole film in a way. And Chris and his wife, Marianne Leone, are also executive producers on the film and were so generous in giving their time. And I think they, you know, they share the experience of seeing intelligence much more broadly, and not just intelligence, but people's capacity to contribute in all kinds of ways to the world. And I do think it's a problem that we often try and measure, you know, in a quantifiable way, what is someone's capacity, you know, whether it's through intelligence testing or through SATs or through standardized testing. And, you know, the reality is that when you talk to big-time corporate executives at places like Google or Apple, they don't necessarily want to know how somebody did in algebra. They want to know, what are their leadership skills like? What are their communication skills like? How innovative are they? How creative are they? How collaborative can they be? Those are the kind of skills you learn in a very diverse environment like an inclusive school like Henderson. You don't learn that through taking a test. So I think it's actually really preparing kids for the real world of employment to have these kind of diverse environments. Hmm.
And you know, you talk about some of the history of the Stanford-Binet IQ test. Mm-hmm. And just briefly, when you learned that history of this test, what struck you?
Well, you know, I'm someone who's lived as a parent of a child with a disability for 18 years. I work at the Institute on Disability at UNH, and I was unaware of some of the unbelievable repercussions of IQ testing in the early part of the 20th century. The fact that almost 90% of Russian Jews and Italians were deemed feeble-minded because they couldn't pass the IQ test at Ellis Island. I didn't realize that hundreds of thousands of people were sent into institutions because of their scores on IQ testing, and that 60,000 people were forcibly sterilized because they wanted to eliminate this feeble-minded population from our society. Yeah, I was blown away, and I really think the history is important for people to understand because, you know, you look at something like Black Lives Matter or the Me Too movement. If you don't know that we're a country that has a history of racism and slavery, you don't understand Black Lives Matter. If you don't understand that we're a country that has systematically oppressed and segregated women, you know, for hundreds of years, you don't understand the Me Too movement. So I think people, in order to understand the inclusive education and inclusive employment movement, need to understand this history.
Mm-hmm. Why do you know, we don't do that anymore, obviously, and use the test to sort of determine who might be feeble-minded, quote-unquote.
We still do very similar things, though.
But in education, right? So why has it been so slow to change in education, do you think?
Right. Well, it's a great question. I mean, schools are big monolithic institutions. And I think just on a federal level, we're trying to determine, well, where do kids belong and how do we decide where kids belong? And sometimes we look for the most blunt instrument. And the IQ test is a very blunt instrument, but I think it's a problematic instrument because it really only measures certain types of a person's ability to contribute. And, I've had experience with other types of assessments for my own son, Samuel. And there are some other assessments out there that are actually much more, I think, effective and realistic in terms of what a person's support needs are and what do they need to be successful in school or in employment or in community life.
Mm. You know, your film also talks about the history of disability rights to some extent and how it's been going on for a long time. The Kennedy family, Rosemary Kennedy's intellectual disabilities, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and shutting down the institutions that were supposed to be caring for people with intellectual disabilities, but instead were mistreating them. But, you know, after those institutions shut down, the appropriate resources were never put into community-based programs to help people with intellectual disabilities. Not enough. And some would argue that our jails have now become our de facto institutions because those resources were never properly appropriated. So how much have things improved, would you say?
I think on all these fronts, I feel like sometimes we take two steps forward and one step back. I mean, my wife, Betsy McNamara, just the other day wrote a piece for our local paper about the wait list in New Hampshire. And there's a wait list in many states where when you turn 21, you lose all that support from the school. The school is then done with you in terms of their support. In many states like New Hampshire, there's a wait list for getting adult services. So there are literally hundreds or even thousands of people around New Hampshire and other states waiting for some type of support once they turn 21 and are just in limbo. So you're right. I mean, you're right. There's, you know, state legislators and governors and certainly the president and the federal level need to understand that in order for people to have the kind of support they need to be employed, to have full community lives, there needs to be money allocated to that. It makes sense, so much sense long term as well, because you're right. Many people end up in prison if they don't have other opportunities or in institutions.
Mm. So what else needs to be done? What do you want people to walk away with after they see this film?
Well, I think the biggest thing would be this notion of what I would call presuming competence. It means when you see someone that moves differently or talks differently or has some type of disability, the best thing to do is presume that they're competent, presume that they can contribute to schools, to employment, to relationships, to families. Unfortunately, I think those differences in our society often lead people to assume that they're incompetent in some way. So I think really if people leave the film and when next time they encounter someone that they're meeting for the first time that may have a disability, particularly an intellectual disability, you know, don't judge them as being incapable of contributing to every aspect of our society, because with the right supports, everyone is going to find strengths. I mean, Nair shows his strength in many ways, particularly through his art. Micah in the film has incredible social and emotional intelligence. He's very active on social media. You know, he's so connected and so kind. Naomi just brings a sense of joy and spirit to the workplace where she is now that charges up the whole workplace. They're all contributing in their own incredibly meaningful ways to the communities around them.
And how widespread would you say acceptance is? Or are you still running into or folks running into a lot of walls and obstacles trying to be included and find a meaningful way to contribute?
You know, I think a lot of it actually comes down to each individual community and what they're doing in their schools. If schools in a community are inclusive of kids of all abilities, then the kids in that community are growing up in that kind of diverse environment. If they're in a community where kids with disabilities are segregated, the kids without disabilities are not having that diverse experience. And I think that stays with them as adults. And when I talk to people around the country, people that have been growing up in inclusive schools have a completely different perspective on disability than people who grew up in a very segregated school. So I think it all comes back to making sure our schools in every community are being truly inclusive.
Okay. Dan Habib, filmmaker at the Institute on Disability at the University of New Hampshire. His latest film is titled Intelligent Lives. It will have its East Coast premiere at the Independent Film Festival Boston on Friday. You can find more information at our website, radioboston.org. Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna and Chris Satorik with help from Zoe Mitchell and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had help today from Eddie Mazulis. Our executive producer is Hitesh Ati. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.